right. So the next, everybody should be on their feet. On your feet. The next presenter, great. Hi, Zoom people. Welcome back. Hope you guys had a really great lunch again. We're missing you. Come on back to Houston next quarter. We're going to look forward to having you here in person. But right now, I just want to tell you a little something about the next presenter. The first time I met Alan O'Neill and I heard his story, I thought, oh my gosh, that is an awesome story. And then I felt challenged in my heart because of this man's heart for his team. And because of the fact that when he stood on the stage and told us, and I won't, you know, I won't jack up your story, Alan. I hope not. But when he stood on the stage and he shared with us what he's going to share with you today, I literally thought, I want to be a better business owner like that. And so I know that you guys are ready to give him a great, big, warm inner circle greeting. So please help me welcome my friend, Mr. Alan O'Neill.
Hear me okay? So I was standing over there and I heard Sherry saying, she's so cute and sleepy. I thought she was talking about me for a minute. And it's the baby. But anyway, it's great. It really is great to be here after the 18 or 20 months we've all endured. It's great to be anywhere in a group, right? So how about we put our hands together for the recovery from coronavirus? Let's do it. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to share my story. I'm an immigrant from Ireland. I came to the U.S. in 1996, and today I run a business that's got, you know, I'm responsible for about 800 employees, and I always have to count it up in my head, but somewhere around $160, $70 million of revenue every year. So I'm going to share with you how I started, what's happened in the meantime, and where I am today. And I share this story with you for one reason and one reason only. It's not in any way self-gratifying, because when you hear me speak, you'll understand that I'm not any way about promoting myself. What I'm trying to do is give you hope, no matter what stage of your business you're at today. And where, whatever stage of the business you're at today, I guarantee you I was there once. So, you know, I consider myself a very ordinary dude. I don't think there's anything special about me. But I do think that I've got a story that if you pay attention to and take some lessons from, maybe it will inspire you to do great things in your life. So that's my goal. So we'll start out, you know, I was born in Dublin, Ireland. As you may know from the accent, it's not a Texas accent. I like to say I'm from East Texas, like really east of Texas. About 6,000 miles east of Texas, to be honest. So started out in Dublin, Ireland. I lived in inner city Dublin, right in the center of town. And I had great parents and I had a really happy childhood. And growing up, we lived in a Victorian house. It was a three-story over a basement house built in the 1840s or 50s. And so from the outside, that looked like a really opulent piece of property. The truth was, it was a tenement home. There was three families living in the home. And we had a basement. So we had two rooms. It was a two-room flat. And my dad divided one of the rooms so we could have a kitchen and a sitting room. And the other room was a bedroom, which was for my mom and dad and three kids. And so definitely didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth, for sure. But, you know, it was a really happy childhood. And to give you an idea about the conditions, because of the era that the homes were built in, indoor plumbing in the home was somewhat limited. So, you know, we had sinks and we didn't have a bathroom. Bath time was Saturday night, And my mother had a big steel tub that she would put in the sitting room, kick my sister out, and myself and my brother would bathe in water that was heated from the gas stove in a pot. That was bath time. Now, nowadays I tend to wash more than once a week, but that's the way it was back then. But, you know, I mean, it was a really happy time. The toilet was, and you notice, like, I'm on to plumbing already, right? So the toilet was out in the backyard. So it was a shed with a corrugated roof. I had a toilet in the building, like in that little shed. And the unique thing about that was, out the back of the house, there was a hill. The hill, the proper name for the hill was Hanover Hill, still there today. But we all knew it as Misery Hill, because the story was that every night after dark, the headless horseman would go across the hill. Scared me to death as a kid. Like, I still don't like going across that hill when it's dark, but scared me to death as a kid. And so, you know, as a kid at night, when I would go to that bathroom, like, I never had a problem with a bowel movement. It scared the living you-know-what out of me, right? So, I mean, it was tough, and it was cold. So you didn't go out there to read the newspaper or anything like that. So, anyway, just to give you an idea of the conditions I grew up in. So, went to school. I was never a big fan of school. Like, it was a means to an end, right? And so, went to school. I was an okay student. I did enough to keep myself out of trouble. Definitely wasn't an A student for sure. I didn't even know grades went that high till I started having kids going to school. But, you know, I always thought C meant, like, cool or complimentary or, you know. Got through school, got to the leaving certificate, which is the same as a high school diploma here. And as soon as I got that, I got out of school immediately. And I start working in a flour mill, and my job was simply to clean down the machines and sweep the floor. So I did that for a few months. And my dad had always told me, look, son, get a trade and you'll never be idle. You'll never need work if you have a trade. And so he was a laborer his whole life. My dad worked for the same company for 49 years. It was the Irish Glass Bottle Company. It is what you think it is. They made glass bottles. And so he was a laborer working in the Irish Glass Bottle Company for 49 years. His goal for me was to get a trade. College was never on the agenda. Like, I didn't even know anyone that went to college, with the exception of my teachers in school. I never knew anyone that went to college. The area I was from, people didn't go to college. They ended up in blue-collar careers. So, you know, it was always on my mind that in order to really please my dad, I need to get a trade. And so there was a national apprenticeship agency in Ireland called ANCO at the time, A-N-C-O. And I registered with ANCO, and I remember the lady saying to me, well, what trade are you interested in? And I said, I don't really care as long as it's a trade. As long as you can get me into a trade, I don't really care what it is. And the first opportunity that came up was plumbing. And so I went for the interview, and they liked me, and they hired me, and I started as an apprentice plumber. And so, you know, I have to say right off the bat, I didn't love the trade. The work was hard. You were constantly on building sites, like it was construction plumbing, and it was cold in the winter time. And I didn't love it, but I came to like it at the start. And I started to like it and started to like what I was doing, and I think I got reasonably good at the trade. And so, you know, I was progressing through the trade and completed my apprenticeship in 80. I started in 77. I completed my apprenticeship in 81. Dating my girlfriend in 1980. That was Linda. That was my first wife, Linda. Now, I will tell you, we got married in 84 and we're still married today. I call her my first wife because look at this. I mean, this is pretty marketable, right? I've got to keep her on her toes. If I just call her my wife, she might get complacent, right? So, hard like that one. So, anyway, I'm still with Linda today, and I will tell you that in case I forget to say it later on, but wasn't for Linda, I wouldn't be standing here today. I definitely wouldn't be as successful as I am. So, behind every great man, you know, you all know the story, right? So, anyway, start dating Linda in 1980. We got married in 84. And 84 was a big year for us. We bought a house, we got married, and life was going great. I was still with the same company I started my apprenticeship with. We were seven years into it. And one day I was working on a school, and my boss came out to visit the job, and he laid us all off. He told us we didn't have any more work for us, and you were laid off. And I remember being, like, really devastated, and I really felt kind of violated by that somebody could be in control of your life like that and tell you that you didn't have any more work. And, you know, we had a mortgage. We were living week to week. We had a car payment. We were really, like, just barely making it. And I remember thinking to myself, like, gosh, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know? And so I had to go look for a payphone. I don't know if you remember those days. Like, we didn't have a cell phone in my pocket. I had to go looking for a payphone, and I had to call Linda, who was at her mom's house. It was the only reason I was able to get a hold of her, because we didn't have a phone at home, but our mom did. And so I called Linda and said, Linda, I just got laid off. And, of course, her first reaction was, what did you do? Right? And I said, I don't think I did anything wrong. We were all laid off. Everyone on the job was laid off. And she said to me, what are we going to do? And I remember what I said, and there was no real thought behind what I said, but I meant what I said. I said, Linda, I don't know what we're going to do, but I'll tell you something. This will never happen to me again. Never. And you know, little did I know that day, because I wasn't into motivational talks or Ziegler or John Maxwell and all that type of stuff. But John Maxwell wrote a book called Intentional Living. And that day I started living intentionally. I was like, nobody's going to have control of me again the way that guy just had control of me. Like, somebody to come to you and say, you can't work anymore for us, and you're not going to get a wage next week, that's tough. And so I said, I don't know, but it's not going to happen to me again. So, I mean, the reality was, that happened on a Friday. I was working by Monday. It wasn't hard to get a job. And I continued to work, but kept thinking about what I promised Linda, that would never happen to me again. And so I enrolled in a class in school at night. It was called the Craft-Based Technician in Plumbing Technology. And the name of the course was a little bit misleading, because what it taught you to do was to design the plumbing in a building, in a multi-story building, and basically be almost like a plumbing engineer. But the commitment was 3 nights a week for 3 years. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 7 to 10, 3 years. So obviously I had to get Linda sign off on that she was okay with me being gone for that amount of time every week. And she said, yeah, whatever you want to do is cool with me. So I went to school and I went through the course and passed it with distinction. And all of a sudden became, like, more marketable. And so I got employed by Trinity College Dublin. Any of you that know anything about the universities in Ireland, Trinity College is one of the most famous old universities in Dublin. And it was right in the center of town. What was cool about that college was, or what was cool about getting the job in that college was, it was a Protestant college. It was built by the Queen, and it was Protestant-based, and I was the second Catholic to be ever employed by that university. It wasn't normal for Catholics to be employed there. And just, I think, it gave me validation that the extra effort I had put in by going to school at night was going to open career doors for me. So I started working in Trinity College, and it was kind of cool. You were in the center of town. It was a good atmosphere in the college. It was fun to be there. But I still felt like I was missing something, like something wasn't 100% like the way I wanted it. So I saw a job in the newspaper for the airline, Aer Lingus, the national airline. And I always wanted to work in the airport. I'm infatuated with planes. and I thought, how cool would it be to work in the airport? Plus, I knew that if you worked for the airline, you got free or very reduced travel. And one of my big things was going to see soccer games in England, and I knew I could fly across free as often as I wanted if I got that job. So I applied for the job and was employed by Aer Lingus as a maintenance plumber. That was kind of a cool job. It was, it was fun in the airport. I got to be around the planes. I got to be up and down the ramp. I got, it was just cool for a young man to do that. And was working away there, and everything was great till I realized that about once a year, we would have to go on strike. It was a very unionized place. And what happened was, because we were technically the aircraft maintenance facility, believe it or not, all the maintenance on planes is done in the summertime. In the wintertime. All the maintenance on planes is done in the wintertime because they want them in the air in the summertime. So all the heavy maintenance is done in winter. And when the company wanted to bring in work practice changes, they always did it in the summer because it wasn't as big an impact if you went on strike. And we had no control over going on strike or not going on strike. We were just told, hey, the union says we're going on strike. So I think it was the second or the third year in a row that we were on strike in the summertime, and I was really getting fed up with this. I was like, look, I want to work all year. I don't want to be out of work for 6 weeks every summer. And myself and my friend were reading the newspaper one day while we were on strike. We were at the airport, but not working, and we saw an ad in the paper for a worldwide lottery for American green cards. And Ken, my buddy, said to me, hey, what about we apply for green cards for the U.S.? Something to do, right? And I said, well, what do you have to do? And he said, well, apparently you just have to send a postcard to this address in Boston, and that's all you have to do and list your dependents. And I said, okay, well, let's do it. So we both apply for this worldwide lottery. It's the summer of 84. I went in 1990, about the summer of 87. Sorry, I'm all screwed up. The summer of 94. We're in the summer of 94. And we apply and then completely forgot about it. So in 1996, I get a phone call from my wife one day, and she said, hey, there's a big envelope here for you from the National Visa Center in the U.S. And I said, okay, open it. And she's like, what is it? And I said, just open it. And I'm like, when she said National Visa Center, I thought Visa card, right? I know what all that was about. So she opens it and she says, dear Mr. O'Neill, congratulations, you have been pulled out of the lottery, the worldwide lottery for an American green card. Please follow the following instructions if you wish to pursue this. And she's like, what is this about? And I said, oh, last year, when we were on strike, Ken and I decided to apply for visas to go to the States. And she's like, well, that's kind of important information. Maybe you should have shared that with me. And I said, it was a passing thing. We just did it. And she's like, well, I said, let's talk about it when we get home. So when I got home, she said, what do you want to do with this? And I said, well, look, I really don't know, but it's an opportunity, right? And she says, yeah, and we kind of put it to the side because you had 6 months to do something with it. And every now and again, we'd talk about it. And finally, she said to me, look, do you want to go or do you not want to go? And I said, I want to go. And she said, well, my opinion is that if we don't go, we'll always wonder what if, right? So we can lease our house, we can sell our car, we can go there, and if it doesn't work out, we can come home. You'll always get a job. And I said, well, we can do that, but I don't really want to give up my job in the airport, so let me go in and ask for a leave of absence. So I went in and I asked for a year's leave of absence. And I don't know if this is a good sign or a bad sign, but they said, yes. I'm like, I mustn't be that valuable, right? But they said, yes, you can take a year off if you want. They gave me this contract that said, if we call you back in the meantime, you need to come back, but we'll try to give you a year. So I did. I took the leave of absence. We leased our house. We sold our car. We were all set to go, and I'll never forget it. I was working on the roof in the airport prior to leaving, to my leaving date. It was around May of 96. We were gone in June, and Linda calls me. By this stage, we had cell phones. Linda calls me, and she says, "Hey, I got some news for you." And I said, What is that?" And she said, "I'm pregnant." And I said, "There was a plane going over my head, but I thought you said you were pregnant." And she said, "That's because I am." And I went, well, I said some words that I can't repeat in the stage. And I said, "How did that happen?" And she said, "Well, I can draw you a picture when you get home, but I hope you know how it happened." So I'm like, this is not great, right? I mean, having a baby's great, but like just the timing and all that, and we were about to leave for the States. And so I call Linda's uncle. Linda's uncle was living in Houston. We decided to go to Houston. I call Linda's uncle. And Linda's uncle said, "You know, you can stay with me for a few weeks when you get here, and then you can get your apartment and get a job, whatever." So call Linda's uncle. Linda's uncle is like 72 or 74 at the time. Not very stable on his feet, you know, he's a big man, not very stable on his feet, and I call him and I said, "Hey Vincent, you know, about this us going over," and he said, "Yeah," he said, "I'm looking forward to it." And I said, "Yeah, well, there's a small problem." He said, "Like, what's the problem?" And I said, "Linda's pregnant." And then he said what I said, "How did that happen?" And I said, "Well, it's a long story." So he said, I said, "The problem is I don't know what to do. I don't know if she can have the baby over there." And he said, "Well, I'll try and find out." So the funny part of this story is Vincent is driving up I-45 a couple of days later, and he sees a sign, and it says, "Pregnant, confused, and an arrow." So he goes, follows the arrow, and goes into, I guess it was the family planning center or, you know, something. Now, you got a picture to see in this 72-year-old man hobbling into the family planning center. And he says, my niece is pregnant, and she lives in Ireland. And she's the lady behind the camp's going, "Oh, yeah, uh-huh." And he goes, "Alan, the place is you." Yeah. So anyway, it turned out we could, you know, we could get Medicaid or whatever it was, and she could have the baby. So we just said, "Look, we've gone this far, let's do it." So we come to America. I'm in Vincent's house, and I'm looking for a job, and I apply for a job with a company called Gerald Plumbing. It was the first company I ended up working for, but I went for the interview, and I was dressed like this. I had a shirt and tie on because that's what you did in Ireland. And I went in, and Jim Wilburn, the owner, Gerald, was there, and he came in. He kept looking at me, and I sat down, and he said, you do know this is a plumbing job, right?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, well," and he liked me and said I could start, and so I started working as a plumber. And it was a rough start because, first of all, plumbing's slightly different here. It's not super different, but it is slightly different. And, you know, I rode with a guy for a couple of weeks, and then I was sent out on my own. And in Ireland, you know, the main shut-off valve is under the kitchen sink. And here it's not, it's outside. And I should have really caught that in the 2 weeks. But, you know, I was so excited at running my first call. I ran the first call. I'll never forget, the lady said, "Yeah, the lavatory is leaking, running water." And I said, "Okay." So I head straight for the kitchen sink, and I opened the doors and start pulling out all the cleaning supplies. And she's like, "What are you doing?" And I said, then I remembered, right? And I said, "No, we like to check everything, you know. You gotta be quick on your feet." And so anyway, I got the water shut off, fixed her lavatory, and I'm away, right? I'm starting to run calls. So I'm running calls for about 4 weeks. And Jim calls me into the office one day and says, "I need to talk to you." And of course, I'm assuming I'm in trouble. I said, "What?" And he goes, "So we had a service fee of $39.95 to go out And then if the customer agreed to the work, we waived the fee. But if they didn't, they were responsible for $39.95. So Jim says, hey, you've been running calls for 4 weeks and you haven't had a single $39.95. What are you doing? What are you saying when you go in there? Because like everyone else has, you know, one a day or one every second day or whatever it might be. And I said, well, I don't, like, I hadn't got a script, right? I said, I don't know, just, like, tell them what's wrong and how much it's going to be to fix them. I look in the price book, I tell them how much it is, and they say, go ahead and I fix it. I said, is that not right? And he said, no, it's great. But he said, you know, we're the highest priced company in Houston. And I said, well, you never told me that. So lesson number one is the way to sell is to believe in what you're selling and not have any fear about the price, right? Because I just didn't know. I didn't know we were expensive. Now, the very next day, I had my first $39.95. In fact, the guy, we used to carry briefcases with our price books and tools, and the guy followed me out to the truck and threw the briefcase into the back of the truck, told me to get out of there. I was an absolute robber, like, said, you're robbing me. And I was like, well, there it goes. Doubt setting in, right? So anyway, I did well with Jim, and we got to around Christmas time, and my wife was getting really fed up with me being gone every day from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. And she was like, Alan, this is not working out like this. And I was like, the marriage or the job? And she's like, no, the job. She said, you're gone all day. We were better off in Ireland. Like, and I said, well, let me look for another job. And I looked for a job. I applied for a job with the Astros in, not as a pitcher, in the Astrodome as a maintenance plumber. And they award me the job. And I go in to quit. And Jim is like, oh, my God. He said, you can't quit. And I said, no, Jim, I can't work all these hours. And he said, well, I'm about to promote you to service manager, but I have the company up for sale, and I can't promote you till the sale goes through. So can you hang in there? So I went home, talked to Linda. She's like, whatever you want to do is cool with me. So I stayed, and he promoted me to service manager. And that was my first, like, foray into management. And I started to find that I was pretty good at getting people to do what I wanted them to do. And I think it was, I'm a bit of a relationship builder, so like I was one of the guys. And so started to do really well. And like a very short year and 3 or 4 months later, Jim came to me one day and he said, you know, I sold the company. They want to move me to Denver and they're going to put you into the president's role. Now, I had gone from being a plumber in the field to being the president of this company in 15 months. The only problem was I had never read a financial statement. And we were now owned by a consolidator where you had to have monthly results call every month. And, like, it was a little bit nerve-wracking for me because I really didn't know what I was doing. And so I hired a controller by the name of Bill Chan. And I said, Bill, you got to teach me how to read this financial statement. And he did. He told me, when you get on the call, here's what they're going to ask you about. Here's what you need to say. And through that process, I learned what to look for in a financial statement, how to understand the statement, what it meant, trends, all that kind of stuff. And so we started to do really well. We went from $2 million in revenue to $4 million in revenue in a couple of years, and we were doing just great. And really, when I look back on that, I really think they gave me that job because there wasn't anybody else that was convenient. But then in the course of that, I proved that I could do the job, and so they were more than happy to let me stay. Well, late 2002, the parent company, which was a $1 billion corporation, filed bankruptcy. So I was the president of this small location in Houston, but we were bankrupt. And so, you know, this is no fun, right? I don't know what to do. And so I didn't like telling suppliers we couldn't pay them for stuff they had sold to us. And so I decided I was going to do my own thing. Well, Jim, my old boss, who had since retired, called me. What are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to start a business. And he said, well, I'll come back and start it with you and we'll be partners. And the deal was that we were 50-50 partners. Jim only wanted to work for a couple of years. And so he said, look, actually, he was in Sugarland. He said, I got a friend who's a banker in Sugarland. Because I really didn't have any money to speak of. I think I had $15,000 or something that I could invest into this thing. But he said, let's go see this banker friend of mine in Sugarland. Now, this is 2003. Things were a lot looser back then with the banks. And so we go into the bank, and Jim said to the banker, look, we got this business plan. We gave him our business plan. And he said, we'd like to borrow some money. And Clinton, the banker, said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you guys $500,000 and you just pay the interest till you get in your feet. And I was like, did he say $500,000? Like, I was like losing my mind. That was more money than... And Jim was like, that sounds great. And I really nearly wet myself. I was like, Jim, how are we going to pay back $500,000? And he said, we don't have to borrow it. It's just a line of credit. I mean, I knew nothing about this business stuff. So anyway, Jim and I started. We did $1 million in revenue in our first year. We did $2 million in the second year. We did $3 million in the third year. And somewhere around the third year, Jim came in and said to me, I want to get out. He'd gone to the doctor, hadn't got great news. Wanted to get out, and we agreed that I would buy his 50% out. And so I did, bought him out, started running the business on my own, and we continued our trajectory. We went 4 million, 5 million, 6 million, 7 million. So we got to $9 million, around $9.3 million in the year of 2011. And around October of that year, I was approached by a company in Houston that wanted to buy us. Now, it's kind of like being asked out on your first date. I got very, enamored with the idea. And it was significant money, and I thought to myself, this would be great. But as I started to have meetings with these people, I realized I didn't like them. I didn't like the people. And so it culminated in, I was in my attorney's office one day, and the guy from the private equity company that owned this business in Houston called my attorney to ask him some questions, and my attorney said, it's the guy. He was telling me the guy was on the phone, and he said, I'll put him on speaker so you can listen in, but he didn't tell him I was listening. And so the guy said, he asked various questions. They were fairly standard questions. And then he asked my attorney, he said, has this guy ever been sued? And my attorney said, no, he's never been sued. And he said, well, I suppose you can't get into much trouble playing with toilets. And that finished me. I'm like, he's got no respect for my trade, and he's got no respect for me, and so I'm done. So I said to Jim, I don't think I'm going to do this deal. And Jim said, the attorney Jim said, go home and talk to your wife, Alan. It's a fair amount of money. And so I went home. I'll never forget, it was Father's Day weekend, and I didn't say anything to Linda immediately, but I was sitting in the backyard, and I kept thinking about it, and finally she came out, and she said, what is wrong with you? Where are you moping around? And I said, this deal. And she's like, yeah. And I said, I don't like these guys. And the attorney, insulted me the other day. And I don't know I want to do this deal. And the wisdom of a woman, right? She said to me, Alan, we have never made a decision based purely on money in the past. So why don't you call the attorney first thing Monday morning, tell him the deal's off. And I said, yes. And it was like somebody lifting a weight off my shoulder. So I called the attorney, said the deal's off. But it did make me think, what am I going to do in the future? Because, this is a delicate situation. So fast forward a few months, we were in my attorney's office again, myself and my wife. We were doing some estate planning. And the attorney said to me, I have a question for you. What's going to happen to Abacus if something happens to you? And I said, I don't know. I never thought about it. And he said, well, you need to think about it. So he looks at Linda and he says, Linda, do you want to run a plumbing company? And she was completely horrified. She was like, oh, no, I don't want any part of that. I don't know anything about it. It's not my deal. And he said, well, you need to prepare an exit plan. So I started to think about, how I would possibly ever exit. And so I hired a consultant. This is another tip for you, is there's consultants out there for everything you need, and if you vet them properly, they can be really valuable to you. So I hired a consultant that specialized in mergers, acquisitions, sales of plumbing, air conditioning, electrical companies. And he would come in once a month and review my financials and say, at the low end, your company is worth this, and at the high end, your company is worth that. He'd also identify areas of opportunity for us to improve. And so we got to a point where in February of 2012, I knew exactly what the company was worth. And so I was approached by another guy, this time out of Seattle. Colin, turned out to be a great guy. Him and I are best friends today. But he was 35 years of age. He was from Stanford. You know, he was a cool dude, very hip, the opposite to me. So he came to the office. We hit it off, really well. And he made me an offer that was above what I thought the company was worth at the high end. And he said, but here's the deal. You got to stay. You have to stay. And not only do you have to stay, you've got to start air conditioning right away. And we were only plumbing. And so we start doing air conditioning. We close the deal. We start doing air conditioning 6 weeks later. And then we move facility across town. And there was a bunch of change all at the same time. And you know, here's another tip for you is you have to be careful with change. I'm okay with change for the most part. But my people weren't, like, they didn't know what was going on. You know, we all of a sudden we were sold. We were doing air conditioning. There was all these boxes in the warehouse that was never there before. And we moved to the far side of town. So my people were, like, reeling a little bit. And so we lost a few people. A few people had emotional breakdowns. Like, it was a tough year, 2012. But we did really well. We did super well. And then... As a byproduct of that, so Colin was the investor, but he was funded by a company out of San Francisco called Alpine Investors. So all of a sudden, I was going to board meetings in San Francisco on the 32nd floor of this building overlooking the Bay Bridge. I mean, you talk about a duck out of water, right? I mean, I'm like, what am I doing here? But anyway, I went to my board meetings. We did really well. We continued to grow. And around about 2015, now, one of the things, when I did the deal with Colin, I kept a piece of the company. I reinvested. Well, basically, I sold it all to him, and I reinvested some of the proceeds that gave me about 20% of the business. And so I was invested in it, and the idea was we were going to run this company for 5 years, and then we would sell again. Now, I told my wife, listen, it's going to be great. I'm selling the company. Probably won't have to work Fridays. That's not what happened. I start working harder, right? So the first year, Colin's wife was pregnant, and the CEO of the company in Dallas, he owned a company in Dallas and a company in Houston, the president, the owner, former owner, started to call in rich, right? Some people call in sick. He was calling in rich. He'd been paid for his company, wasn't showing up to work, and like really I could see the end was coming. And him and Colin had a big blow up, and he decided he was going to resign. And so Colin came to me and he said, hey, I want you to be the Texas CEO. I was like, CEO? What does that stand for? I thought it meant Colin emails often, which he did. But... So he wanted me to be the CEO and take over both companies. So I go to Dallas on the day that the guy is resigning up there. He tells the staff, I mean, the exit speech was amazing. He gets up to the top of the room and he said, and keep in mind, he's owned this company for 30 years. He stands up there and he said, hey, I'm leaving. Alan's taking over. You're going to like him. He talks like Bono. And that was the speech. And I'll never forget it. I was standing up the front of the room, and the guys in the front row, the technicians in the front row, their mouths were wide open. Like, they were in complete shock. So I stand up there, and I say, listen, guys, I know that you're in shock. And when I said that, Colin's at the back of the room like, don't say that. But I could see these guys were shocked, right? And I said, look, I know you're in shock, and all I can promise you is that life is going to be at least equally as good under me as it was under Bill, and I'm going to take care of you. And it was a crazy morning. After the meeting, we go into Bill's office, and Bill's old office, and Colin says to me, well, what were you saying they were in shock for? Like, they were fine. And with that, one of the managers comes in and says, one of the guys who'd been there for like 20 years was throwing open the parking lot, like physically throwing open. So I arranged to meet the guy the next day, and his name is Perry. He's still there today. And I said, Perry, what's wrong? Like, what's the problem? And he said, you don't understand. I said, I understand what you're going through. And he said, you don't understand anything. I said, okay, tell me about it. And he said, that man that just quit found me bathing in Lake Grapevine. I didn't have a home. I was homeless. I didn't have a job, and I didn't have any money, and I was hungry. And he gave me a job as a parts runner, and now I'm the HVAC manager, and I have a beautiful home. I have a wife of beautiful kids. And he said, the man that gave me all that just walked out the door, and you're telling me you understand? You've got to be kidding. Wow. You talk about tail between your legs. So I said, look, Perry, all I can ask you to do is trust me. I won't let you down, and I've never let him down. You know, we got through that. That was 2012. 2015, I go to a board meeting. We're only 3 years in. The promise was we were going to run this company for 5 years and sell it. And I'm at the board meeting. And the Alpine Group, there was three of them. There was Colin and there was me. So there was like three private equity investors, Colin and me. And Graham, he said, so, Alan, we have news for you. We're going to sell the company. And I went, whoa, 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 that's not what we agreed to. And he said, well, the market's crazy. We're going to sell it. And you know, that's how it is. And I said, well, do we not get a vote? And he said, oh, do you want to vote? Everybody in favor. And forward and put up their hands, right? Everybody not in favor. And I put up my hand. So I was outvoted, right? Lesson for me there is once you let go, you're now an employee, right? You don't. You've only got a certain amount of say-so. So anyway, we sold, and I had no idea what the proceeds would be, but we sold, and it turned out my 20% was worth more than my original 80%, right? I don't say that to impress you. I say it simply that I remember when I sold the first time my CPA saying, whatever you're getting now the first time, make sure that that's enough to keep you the way you want to be kept, because you might never get another dime out of this. But we sold again in 2015, and I did better the second time than I did the first time. So the second time they said to me, okay, here's what you can do. We're now going to be owned by a company out of New York called Investcorp, and you have an opportunity to reinvest some of the proceeds. Would you like to reinvest some of your proceeds? And I went, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. So I reinvested some of my proceeds, and we sold again in 2019. And guess what? My proceeds in 2019 were greater than my proceeds in 2015. And so, but one of the things we did when we sold in 2015 was I said, look, guys, like, I'm doing really well out of this. But the team is not. And sooner or later, they're going to ask, like, what's in it for us, right? We keep doing this, but what's in it for us? And so we agreed that we would create what we call profit units. And the idea of the profit units was that they were worth zero when the guys got them, the guys and ladies got them. But there was a cutoff, so the private equity company wanted to get a certain return. They wanted 3x on their money. But anything above 3x, the people could participate in, right? So we selected 11 people from the three companies in Texas, 11 managers from the three companies in Texas, and we said, we're going to give you these profit units. And our management case when we were selling was to get to a certain number. If we get to this number, every time, every dollar we exceed that number by, you're going to participate in. And so they were like, well, it's free money, right? It's absolute free money to us. If we don't get anything, we don't get anything, but we might get something. And we showed them that these profit units could be worth a considerable amount of dollars to them as we grew. And so what it did, like for everybody here that's running people, it completely changed the game for our people. All of a sudden they had skin in the game, although they didn't have to put any money in, they had skin in the game and it allowed them to participate. Well, in 2019 we sold again. And when we sold the second time, I got a waterfall, what they call a proceeds waterfall, which said, here's what everybody's getting. And I went home that night and I was in bed with my wife, and it doesn't get any spicier than that, by the way. I went home and I was lying in bed with my wife. What's wrong with you? And I said, we just made 11 people. 11 people. Yeah. And I said to her, I said, Linda, it's not the money, but we've changed their family tree forever. Right? We've changed their family tree forever. And so we really, like, I think it was a turning point in life for me when I realized that not only, like, I was taken care of back in 2012. To be honest with you, if I didn't want to work another day past 2012, I was just fine. But I stayed on for a couple of reasons. One, because I love what I do. It's the only place where I don't get told what to do, because when I get home, I get told what to do. So, like, if I can be the boss somewhere, it's better than nowhere, right? But honestly, like, I felt like I could change people's lives for the better, right? And as I lay there that night and I started thinking about, like, how much we change these people's lives, the quote that came to mind was Ziegler, right? It was, you can have everything in life you want if you just help enough other people get what they want. And we had just helped 11 people get more than they ever thought they would get, right? And so what was interesting was in 2019, when we did that transaction, we asked every one of the 11 people, we said, hey, now keep in mind, these are people that, by all accounts and standard, had ordinary jobs, right? Probably never thought they'd have 7 figures in the bank at one time. But what we did, like by getting them that amount of money and changing their family tree forever, we said to every one of them, okay, there's a couple of options. You can take all your money and run, you know. We don't want you to leave, obviously. But you can take your money and do what you want with it, or you can reinvest some of the proceeds if you want to. But you're going to get more profit units for the next time, right? 11 out of 11 reinvested some of the money. And what that told me was every one of them had confidence in two things. They had confidence in what the company could potentially do, and they had confidence in me as a leader. Because every one of the 11 said to me, what are you doing? And I said, I'm reinvesting some money. I said, look, I'm not very smart, but every time I reinvest money, they give me back more than I gave them. So, I mean, I think it's a fair deal. So, so every one of the 11 reinvested, and every one of the 11 got more proceeds. And I would say we're 15 to 16 months, maybe 12 to 16 months away from selling again. And the company will be worth at least 4 times what it was the last time we sold. So for every dollar that they put in the first time, like when they invest money in the enterprise, they have the same level of earning that the private equity company has. So if the private equity gets 4x, they get 4x. Now the profit units, they have to hit that 3x, and then it kicks in. But they'll get some money from the profit units, and they'll get some money from their proceeds that they turn. So, you know, people often ask me, they say, Alan, what is it about you that my banker said to me one time, I need to just ask you where to put my money, because every time you invest money, like, it gets bigger. And I said, look, I'll tell you this. I said, there's nothing special about me, nothing. But nobody will outwork me, nobody. And I will work and work and work and work till I make it work. I remember the first time that Colin invested in the company, he was talking about the investment, and I said, Colin, look, here's what my goal is. I said, my goal is to make this the best investment that you ever made. And he went, wow. And I said, yeah. And you know, we're friends today, so he tells me it was the best investment he's ever made. And so that's the heart that I went into that deal with. The other thing is, when we were making that deal, my wife said to me, Alan, there's one thing you got to promise me when you do this deal. And I said, what is that? And she said, no regrets. Zero regrets. It doesn't matter where the company gets to 50 million in sales, or, like, and keep in mind we were 9 million at the time, so 50 million seemed like a crazy number. But she said, no regrets. If you're doing it, do it. Take what they give you and move on. But no regrets. And it was a great piece of advice, right? I never look back. You know, today that company in Houston that I started in 2012 is $63 million of revenue. It's 315 or 20 people. We've changed a lot of lives in that company. I often talk about a young man who was 18 and started with us, and he actually, I always remember, because he started with us the same day my daughter started in SFA to get her undergraduate to be a teacher. And Chris started with us, and Emma started in SFA, and Emma went through SFA, got her undergraduate. She went to Texas A&M, she got her master's, and she works in education. She'll never, ever catch Chris in earnings unless she does something other than education. Not shooting down education, I think it's a vocation, and anybody that does it is a saint. But the reality is, we're giving young people that are written off by society because they're not ready for college, we're giving them the opportunity, and many of you do too, I know, we're giving them the opportunity to change their lives. And you know, to me, like, we've won all kinds of Better Business Bureau awards and this and that, and, you know, but when you look at somebody that shows up at work every day and you've changed their life, it's amazing. We have a couple of parties a year. Thank you. We have a couple of parties a year. We have a crawfish boil in April. Now, I will tell you, I don't get the whole crawfish thing. Like, they're nasty little creatures that live in the mud, and you're supposed to, like, do a ton of work to get this little bit of meat. I don't get it. But the guys get it and the girls get it. So we have a crawfish boil in April, and we have a Christmas party, or we have a fajita party in October, and we have a Christmas party in December. The first two parties are always family parties. The last one's just for employees and their spouse. But what I will tell you is, every time I see everybody together, I get emotional, because I realize that ultimately I'm responsible for those people, right? And if you can always keep that in mind, that you are responsible for those people, and it's, you know, when they go home at night, when daddy goes home to the wife and kids at night, or mom goes home to the husband and kids, my decisions, our decisions as business owners, are ultimately affecting the well-being of that family. And if you keep that in mind, you'll always make great decisions, okay? Let me finish with this, guys. I can tell you this as an immigrant, a legal immigrant. There's lots of division in our country at the moment, right? Every one of us have one thing in common. And that one thing in common is that we all woke up this morning in the greatest country in the world, bar none, for opportunity. Please don't waste it. Please don't waste it. There's people all over the world who give their right arm, literally their right arm, to be here today and have the privilege of working and living in the United States. Be proud of this country. It's an amazing country, the best in the world. And get out there and make it happen. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Wow. Didn't I tell you? I almost just said about the millionaires when I was introducing you, and I'm like, I better not. He might want to save it for his presentation. So does anyone have any questions that you would like to ask Alan? You're thinking about it?
From Ireland, we have one of our members typing in.
Okay.
Come on, Irish. Well done from Dublin, Ireland.
Excellent. That guy's okay. Or that girl.
Any questions? Or I will let Alan go. All right. Right over here. Thank you, Santi.
Edgar here. These profit units, is there a guideline or a book or you teach that or how we can make that work into our own company?
No, but I'll tell you, like, if you actually think about it, there is a way to make it work. So your company is worth a certain amount of money today. And you know, the old equation was about 5x EBITDA or net profit. Like, that's gone out the window now because valuations have gone up so much. But if you can put a value on your company today or have someone to value it, and then you'll definitely want to get a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, but you can say to your team, you know, I'm planning on exiting or selling, or even if you're not, the value of this company, once it gets beyond this, you're going to get to participate. So say your company's worth $100 today. When our company gets to $300, you're going to participate in every dollar above that. And you can decide what that percentage is. Is it 1%, is it 5%, is it 10%, whatever it is, right? And when you think about it, the private equity companies, they're taking no risk because they know they want at least 3x return. And once they get 3x return, everything else is shareable. Now, they take a share of that over and above as well. But you can design profit units any way you want. You're in charge of it. But you've just got to have something that whatever you decide, then you've got to pay, right? I mean, if you decide, hey, when my company gets 3x what it is today, everybody shares in the proceeds, you're going to need to spell out what their share is. Like, we all had a waterfall document that showed, you know, at 4x it's this much, at 5x it's this much. And so you can design it any way you want. You're in charge of it for your company. Yeah. So.
Thank you, Edgar. Very cool. Did I see another hand? Okay, Mr. Boss, and then we have somebody in the back. Greg, just come grab my microphone.
Yesterday, you said you lose a lot of employees. You got over 300 employees, and they resonate, they go somewhere else. I know you answered the question, but I was in this lady, but I know. How many employees do you lose? You said you lost, like...
Yeah, so... The year I got concerned about it, we had 52% turnover, which was shocking to me, right? But we were expanding really fast, and we were hiring really fast. And so today, we have it down to 28% now, 28% of people that come, leave. It's basically a construction environment, right? And so the average in our industry is 40%, 40% turnover. We're down to 28% now. And like I explained yesterday, We achieved that going from 52 to 31 to 28. We achieved that by focusing on how we were hiring. We started to get really particular about how we hire. And if you do a good job on the front end, not as many are going to fall out on the back end.
So the question is, you get that big of a turnover, mm-hmm. people leave. Do you ever take them back?
We take them back once. So it's a great question. So I used to do unlimited, like they could come and go and come and go and come and go, particularly if they were really good. But what I found was that once people realize there's no risk to leaving, and a competitor offers them a sign-on bonus or, you know, whatever, and we have a reputation for training our people really well, so competitors want our people. So once people realize that there's no penalty to leaving, then they'll leave, right? So what we said was anybody can leave once. Unless it's or some kind of medical or family reason, anyone can leave once and come back. But once you leave once and come back, then you can't leave again or you're not coming back, right? And that kind of arrested that coming and going thing. But great, great question. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
Do you still have the rental property in Ireland?
I have no rental properties in Ireland. Yeah, I have no rental properties in Ireland. But we are thinking about buying a property in Ireland when I retire. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Maria, you want to just come back this way?
I wrote it down in case I forgot. So it's not more of a question. It's more of a saying. I'm not a business owner myself. I'm more of an employee. So I just want to thank you for considering. And I spoke with, I let you guys know as business owners, be considerate of your employees and, you know, let them know that they're doing a good job. And, you know, I want to thank you for considering their families because you do save people's lives by yeah. just, you know.
Thank you, Maria. Them. Thank you. Look, it's so competitive out there. You've got to give people a compelling reason to work for you. And you know, we've done numerous things in the last couple of years. Like, we have four-day weeks now for technicians that want to work 4 days a week. We have no on-call for plumbers. So we don't make our plumbers go out in the middle of the night. Now, we do have a couple of guys that work the night shift because we do get calls at night. And my biggest fear is that we leave a leak in someone's house and we can't fix it in time. And so we have a couple of plumbers that just work the night shift. They come in at 10 p.m. They work till 7 a.m. But it taken away that on-call. When I was a plumber in the field, I hated that more than anything else. I absolutely hated, well, it was a pager back then, my pager going off, and some lady at 2 o'clock in the morning decides that garbage disposal isn't working and it's an emergency, right? It's terrible. But you got to go. It's your job. So, yeah, we've done a lot to help the work-life balance, I guess is the best way to. Yeah.
Thank you. And so to close off, would you do me a favor and share your three promises?
Yeah. So, Sherry, a couple of years ago, one of my managers came to me and said, hey, I'm having a trouble getting this guy across the line. We were interviewing a guy. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, look, every time I tell him something great about this company, he says, everybody does that. So I said, well, give me an example. He said, well, you know, I told him we pay you really well. Everybody does that. We give you spiffs for selling certain items. Everybody does that. We do trips as incentive. Everybody does that. And I was like, wow. Okay, let me go talk to him. So I go talk to him, and I'm having some small talk with him. And finally, he said to me, just give me the main reason I should come to work for you. Give me a reason. And I was like, look at this. You get to look at this every day. No. But I was like, I mean, we're a great company. We've been around for so many years. And he's like, but anyway, we got him across the line. But it made me think that I got to go find compelling reasons that people will want to come to work for us. And I devised three promises. Now, I don't think there's anything special about the promises, but it's how we use them is special in my mind. So the three promises are, number one, we will make you a better plumber, air conditioning tech, electrician, accountant, customer service rep, whatever you might be. We'll make you better at your job by training you. Number two, we will make you a better person That raises an eyebrow, right? Because they go, how are you going to do that? Well, a lot of our training time is spent on communication. And what I will tell you is the better communicator you are, the better husband or wife you're going to be, the better brother or sister you're going to be, the better uncle you're going to be, whatever it might be. But if you get really good at communication, you're going to be better at home. And last but not least, if you stay with us for any length of time, we will leave you in a better financial position than when you started with us. Now, there's nothing magical about the three promises, except when somebody is leaving, during the exit interview, one of the questions they're asked is, did we live up to our three promises? They answer very honestly when they're leaving. They're quite happy to answer it honestly. And generally we do. Generally we do. But the magic happens when they go work for someone else and they don't care about promising anything. And so over 70% of people that voluntarily leave try to come back within the first 12 to 24 months. Okay? So what we're doing is on the way out the door, we're reminding them that we made these promises and we kept them. Now, if they're really mad, like, they go, no, hell no, you didn't. Yeah, you know. But if they're really, like, willing to think about it, we did live up to the promises. We do live up to the promises. We work really hard at them. So they're important. Yeah.
Well, you have delivered on your promise to give us something of great value today, Alan and Neil.
Thank you, Charis.
Thank you so much. One more round of applause.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.